Thank you for the introduction. So it's always a pleasure to be here. And I really want to thank Bianca, Benjamin, and Stephanie for the organization and the invitation. So I'm going to talk about something I've been working on with Bianca in the past couple of months. So it's still very recent, meaning there are still a lot of open questions to be answered. Thank you for coming, Bianca. Yeah. So there are still lots of open questions. However, the subject and the calculation are still so simple that I get to speak on the introduction day, right? So this is about calculating the partition function of 3D gravity on the solid torus. And we'll see why it can be interesting and how can we do that. So the context is as follows. You take your flat metric on a 3D infinite space. So this is supposed to be quite familiar. And then you do something to change the topology. So at each value of the coordinate r, you change the topology using some identification map. So you make it torus. So the identification map identifies a point of coordinate t and phi to t plus beta and phi plus theta. So I'm just going to draw it on the blackboard very quickly. Here I have a point t phi. So I identify it by first moving up to height beta and then rotating the cylinder by an angle theta, like that. All right? So that's my identification map. And it turns a flat space into some kind of thermal space. Right?
Isn't this just the rigidly rotating torus that you're getting?
So if you look at the on-shell action, well, bulk action is zero. So you end up with the Gibbons-Hawking-York term. And you can evaluate it at a fixed radius. You find 2 pi beta. So it only depends on the height of the cylinder of the torus. You can also try to do one loop calculation in the Einstein-Hilbert formalism. And that was done very recently, a few months ago, in 2015, by Barnish and collaborators. This one loop calculation is believed to be exact on account of the theory being topological. And so you set q equals exponential I theta. And you get the one loop determined here. So it's product over k greater than or equal to 2, 1 over the squared modulus of 1 minus q to the k. All right. So the main question I had initially was, can we reproduce that result using discrete gravity, using the kind of approach we're here to discuss this week, and in particular using Regge calculus? So The motivation when I saw that result from Barnish, I was quite excited and I thought, I really want to do some calculation like that. I felt the urge to calculate something, you know. So you take a topology, triangulate, and try to evaluate your partition function. So also, well, I mean, it seems like quite a simple result. So there was a reason to try that specific topology. And although quite simple, it carries some deep information about the structure of the model because it turns out that the one loop determinant plus the on-shell action kind of combines to form a character of the BMS group. And you might know that the BMS group is the group of asymptotic symmetry of flat space. So although quite simple, this result carries some algebraic information about the structure of theory. So you might ask at the discrete level whether there are some asymptotic, some generators of those asymptotic symmetries, and whether we can say eventually something about ADS-CFT. I'm not going that far though. So because that's a workshop on renormalization of discrete gravity models, I'll be mostly interested in the continuum limit, which as you know is the same thing as the renormalization, right? So in particular, because 3D gravity is topologically invariant, we know that we can have discrete models that are triangulation independent in the bulk. So it seems like it's going to be quite simple. However, because it's a solid torus, you have a boundary. And then the question is whether the continuum limit is required or not on the boundary. So that will be the main topic. So before we go to the discrete, I just want to have a quick look at the continuous calculation. So you take your Einstein-Hilbert action there. Well, it's not written there, but you take it. And you expand it and do one loop calculation. So that's the one loop free energy. And it always looks like a sum over some operator delta I, and you take the logarithm of the determinant of that operator, which are, those operators are functional operators, right? So when you want to calculate those determinants, you can use the Heekern methods typically. So that tells you, that gives you a representation of the logarithm of the determinant of that operator minus some regulator, a squared mass, that eventually is sent to zero. So it gives you a representation of that object as an integral over some fictitious time, S, of the trace of the Heek kernel, the kernel of that operator here. Okay? So then that reduces the problem to calculation of Heek kernels and integrals of it. So the strategy, because you're on a non-trivial topology, on a torus, the strategy is to first evaluate the kernel for flat space and then use some method that's called the method of images to find the kernel on the coset space, on the torus. So the formula looks like this. This is the Heek kernel on the coset space, and you find it by taking the kernel on flat space, and on the second point here, you use the identification map gamma n times. So that's the identification map I kind of draw here, right? So you use the n times and you sum over all those images, right? So the method is actually pretty standard. So it's kind of straightforward, although the calculations are quite lengthy and messy. Okay, now if we want to go to the discrete, we first have to choose the triangulation. And actually, that's an interesting point because we want to use triangulation independence to make the calculation easier. In the continuum, they didn't use the triangulation independence at all. So we want to use that. Okay, I'm looking at regi calculus, meaning that the variables are the edge length instead of a continuous metric. So I'm kind of assuming you all know about regi calculus a bit. If you don't, just tell me. I can have a couple of minutes. Okay. So let's say I can have that triangulation of the torus. So it looks like a triangulation of the cylinder. But what you do is you identify the bottom triangle there with the top triangle there, and you get a torus. So that would be a triangulation with three tetrahedra. And you can notice that all the edge length, all the edges, lie on the boundary, meaning there's nothing to be integrated over in the bulk. So it means that if that were a good triangulation, I would have to have everything on the measure, on the boundary. So I would know the result before doing any calculation. So that seems like a very bad triangulation for what I want to do. Another issue with that triangulation, that when I identify the bottom triangle with the upper triangle there, well, let's say, look at that vertex, and you can identify it with three possible different vertex on the top. So it means that the angle theta of my identification map here, so I call it the twist angle, can only have three values, right? Can be either 0 or 2 pi over 3 or 2 pi over 3 times 2. So it looks like I'm very constrained on my topology. And the last thing, that it doesn't seem like I can get any continuum limit on the boundary. And I can tell you already that the actual result, the one loop determinant that we're interested in, it really comes from the fluctuations of the length of the edges that are incident to the boundary. And I have none of them here, okay? So that's a bad triangulation. So instead of that one, we're going to discretize the torus in the following way. So I think the picture is pretty explicit. I'm just going to try and describe it. So you take a cylinder, And if you look at a slice, you have a circle. So you discretize that circle using a polygon, an n-gon, right? So an n-gon like that. And eventually in that discretization, you have n angular pieces, okay, all around the cylinder. And you discretize the time too with m time pieces, okay? So that, in particular, if you look at the boundary, it can be as fine as you want, okay? Because I have n angular pieces and m time pieces. So you embed the whole thing into flat space. That gives you a solution of the equation's motion for 3D gravity. So let's look at the assignment of the length now for the background, the flat background. So the distance between the central axis of the cylinder and the boundary is capital R. That's the radius of the torus, of the solid torus. Then I have a discretization scale. Benjamin talked a lot about the scale this morning. So here's mine. Because I have a background, this is actually much simpler. So the discretization scale is the length L of those edges on the boundary. And so you can introduce L squared over R squared to be a parameter that I call 2a, where a is 1 minus the cosine of 2 pi over n. So that's a lot of variables, but it just means something very simple. The discretization scale is controlled either by L or by a or by n. It just whatever you want to choose as a parameter. And obviously, when n is large, so you go close to the continuum, you have this very familiar relation from Euclidean geometry. So the total height of the cylinder is the time step t times number of time step m. The angular twist theta is some integer a divided by n, where basically a means that I take a point here, go up there, and then rotate by a angular pieces, okay? And in the continuum, obviously, a scales with n so that theta is a constant. Okay, so this is not quite a triangulation yet. The basic blocks are prisms. So the only thing I'm left to do with is to triangulate the prisms. And to do that, I can just go back to my previous picture, because that is a prism triangulate with three tetrahedra, all right? So I do get a triangulation of the solid torus where the boundary is as fine as you want. So now I look at the action in the bulk first. First I look at the bulk, and in the second part of the talk I'll look at the boundary more precisely. So let's look at the bulk action. So the radial action has the familiar form, sum over all the edges, the length of the edge times 2 pi minus the number 2 pi minus the sum over all the dihedral angles of the tetrahedra that share the edge E. All right? Is this familiar for all of you? Yeah? I think so. So we know that we can discretize 3D gravity in a way that preserves all the gauge symmetries, meaning that the discrete version will have the same gauge invariances as the continuous theory. So in particular, in the context of radial calculus, it means that I can move around the vertices. I have some vertex displacements that leave the action invariant, both in time and space direction. And when I move the vertex around, it's still flat space, and it's still the same physical solution, right? So this really is a gauge invariance. Now, when you linearize radial calculus, you expect those symmetry to translate to null vectors of the Hessian matrix, okay? So we're going to be careful and look all the time, basically, we're going to look at the null vectors of our matrices. So here's my linearization. It starts with the Hessian, the quadratic terms. And the Hessian H is a matrix. So the matrix elements depends on two edges, E and E prime. And it's defined as the second derivatives of the action with respect to both to the length of both edges, evaluating on the flat background. Okay? So at first, I gotta say, I was a bit reluctant to do that calculation. I was kind of afraid of calculating that Hessian, but hopefully I had Bianca with me, and she was really on it, calculating very fast. And eventually, we actually found a very easy way to, we both found some easy ways to evaluate that Hessian, especially if you own Mathematica. So the idea is first to look at a single tetrahedron like that, so with six edges, look at the dihedral angle theta 1 at the edge 1, and the Hessian is the derivative of the dihedral angle at this edge with respect to the length of another edge of the tetrahedron. So in particular, it's zero if E and E prime don't belong in the same tetrahedron. If they do, then well, you can perform some elementary geometry that gives you the cosine and the sines of the dihedral angle. So the formula is not too complicated. In fact, you actually need the area of the triangles spanned by, well, the edges. And you need the volume of the tetrahedron. Then you can just differentiate that expression and use that to simplify the derivative. So if you do that, you notice a particular structure that was first identified by Bianca Dietrich, Laurent Frel, and Simone Spezial. You find that structure that the matrix elements between E and E prime look like the length of E, the length of E prime divided by the volume of the tetrahedron, times some simple function. And here, the simple function only depends on the discretization parameter A. Okay? So it has very simple structure. So obviously, it's very convenient to have some formal calculation software because those expressions can be quite lengthy when you start to differentiate them. But eventually, it's very simple. Okay. So you got your Hessian matrix, and it seems like it's very complicated because you have n angular pieces, m time pieces, so lots of variables. So what you do is something that you know you learned in undergraduate school. You do Fourier transform. So here S denotes the angular position and n the time position, and you do a space-time Fourier transform that's actually a little bit subtle because you have an angular twist when you make the identification to get a torus. But still, you can do Fourier transform. So you get Fourier coefficients for all the variables. And you have frequencies. So instead of a variable depending on the angular position and the time position, you get variables that depend on two frequencies, an angular frequency k and a time frequency p. Okay? With some very familiar expression, I assume. So I have three types of variables. Here is my prism, discretized, triangulated with three tetrahedra. So I have those edges that go from the central axis to the boundary at a fixed time. So I call them R. You have four of them here. There's obviously the time length here, T of n, at step n. And because you have to triangulate the prism, you also have edges that go from the central axis to the boundary, but they are diagonal, right? So I call them d, d of s and n, d of s plus 1 n, and so on. OK? So three types of variables that I have to integrate over. So my partition function would be an integral over all these variables times the exponential of, well, the Hessian contracted with R, D, and T, all right? So when I do Fourier transform, all the frequencies decouple, and I get just a product of all angular and time frequencies of some integral that only depends on the frequencies through the Hessian here. So H of K and P is the Hessian at fixed frequencies, right? And then you evaluate that integral. It gives you 1 over the determinant of that Hessian at fixed frequencies, and take the product over all frequencies. So it's very, very elementary. So let's just look at the Hessian. You introduce that quantity delta k here, which turns out to be the eigenvalues of the Laplace operator for the angular direction. And it appears very naturally here. So you see the Hessian has delta of k in various places here. So if you look at the first row and the first column, you'll see it actually corresponds to the variable t, the time fluctuation. And it only couples to the other variables through the k equals zero mode. So as soon as k is non-zero, I actually have, in fact, a 2x2 matrix, okay, that doesn't involve the time fluctuations. So it's very simple again. So t at frequency p only couples to k equals zero. And otherwise, I have a 2x2 matrix with where I can identify 3 types of null vectors. Remember, I want to look at null vectors because they correspond to gauge symmetries. So I have a null vector at k equals zero, and they correspond to displacements of the vertices that lie on the central axis of the cylinder in the time direction. Okay, so you can move them around in the time direction at k equals zero. At k equals plus minus 1, you have the spatial displacements of those same vertices. So they lie on the central axis, and you can move them around in the space directions. So 3 types of null vectors, and when k is greater than or equal to 2, you have non-gauge modes. So these are the modes you're going to integrate over. So the one loop determinant will look like something that starts at frequency k equals 2. Then all the time frequencies p of the determinant of the Hessian at fixed frequency. So you can perform the product over the time frequencies. You get something like that. And it's quite remarkable. So it depends, this product over p depends on k. But you see, it does not depend on m. So I will comment in a moment about that. So you do that calculation, it's very simple, and you get that. So when you want the one loop correction, you get 1 over this. So it's this product from k equals 2 to some bound that depends on n of 1 over the squared modulus of 1 minus q to the k. So it does have exactly the same form as the continuous result. It has the desired form, and we found it in a very simple way that was just completely elementary geometry and elementary calculation. As I said, this product here, this product over p gives you something here that's independent of the number of time steps. So it means that if you try to coarse grain the time direction, well, it's going to be invariant. So the coarse graining will be trivial in the time direction. So you can integrate time slice and get the same form. The second thing is that at finite n, so finite number of angular pieces, so you get the form that you want, but it's not exactly the continuous result because you have a bound on the modes here. All right? So you do need the continuum limit to recover the continuous result. You do need the continuum limit in the angular direction only, okay? So you don't need it in the time direction, but you do need it in the angular direction. And I think it's also quite obvious that the result is determined by those edges that are incident on the boundary. Because as I say, the time variable doesn't really couple most of the time for k greater than 2. You only have a 2x2 matrices, and that involves only those edges of type R and D, okay? So only the edges that are incident on the boundary. So that's not surprising because we know that 3D gravity is topological, so everything that happens in the bulk doesn't really matter eventually. So we could expect that if there is a non-trivial result, it comes from the boundary. but just why do I have some degrees of freedom on the boundary? So I just want to tell you that. So it's actually very well known. It's not something that I did personally. So it's just gauge theory in the presence of a boundary. So imagine you have a gauge theory. So your variable is a connection, a gauge field A, and you find a solution of the equations of motion. Let's call it A star. Okay, that's my solution. So around that solution, you can parameterize the connection A in terms of A star with the gauge transformation on it. So A depends on A star and a gauge parameter G. Now you plug that parameterization back into the action. And the bulk term obviously does not depend on the gauge parameter because it's gauge invariant. So it only depends on A star. But you might get some boundary terms, and these boundary terms, they will depend on A star for sure, but they might also depend on G, in fact, typically. So I'm not going to do it on here on the blackboard, but you can do it with Chern-Simon theory on your PI sheets. So you can do that, and you'll find that the boundary term here will be a West domain of Witten terms for the gauge parameter. So you do get degrees of freedom on the boundary. If you add in the boundary conditions, let's say for ADS at infinity, you actually find that the West domain of Witten terms, West domain of Witten term reduces to a Liouville action on the boundary. You can also look at the central charge of that Liouville action, and it does match the Brown and Eno central charge that I found in the 80s looking at the asymptotic symmetries of ADS. So this is something you can do in Chern-Simons, but you can also try and do it in the metric formalism, so that was done by Carlip. And you still find a Liouville action, and you also identify where it does come from. So it comes from the fluctuations of the variables that are the fluctuations of the radius, basically. So for me, these variables are the variables R here, okay, that go from the central axis of the torus to the boundary. So it does seem like, you know, we get kind of the same things in the sense that the degrees of freedom always come from those fluctuations. So when we started this project, we weren't aware of those calculations about the Liouville action, but we did feel that there was something to be done with the boundary, so we decided to look at the boundary more carefully. So if you do reach a calculus with boundary, you actually have boundary action. I think it was found by Hartle and Sorkin. So it looks like a sum over the edges on the boundary. The length of the edge times pi minus the dihedral angle theta e. So what is this angle? You're on the boundary. It's a two-dimensional boundary. So you have edges that are shared by two triangles. And you look at and it's embedded into three-dimensional space. So you look at the dihedral angles between those two triangles, okay, when they share an edge. So that's theta e here. Okay, so with the specific triangulation I chose for my discrete torus, the boundary looks like this kind of thing. So I again have three types of edges. If I choose a regular configurations, turns out that the angles theta e, they vanish for the horizontal edges and the diagonal edges, but they don't vanish for the vertical edges, because the vertical edges are those, you know, that kind of turns around the cylinder like that. So, and if you choose a regular configuration, there will be 2 pi over n for sure. Then you can evaluate that boundary action, and you find 2 pi beta. So exactly the same result as in the continuum. In particular, it depends only on beta. Then you want to look whether that result is robust. So you want to look at perturbations. So you find that it's invariant to first order under displacements of the vertices in the time direction. Yep. And you also find that it's invariant to first order under displacements of vertices in the angular direction, provided that all the time steps have the same length. So it's kind of weird, but that's what you find. So then you go further and look at the Hessian. So not the Hessian only for the boundary matrix, for the boundary action, but for the whole action. So bulk terms plus boundary terms. So S is the sum of bulk and boundary terms. This is the quantity I'm interested in, where delta L of E and delta L of E prime are fluctuations of the length. So the Hessian has natural block structure into four blocks. You have a block that's the coupling of the bulk fluctuations to themselves. So that's the block I analyzed in the first part of the talk, where if I integrate only that part, I'll find the one-loop determinant I told you about. Okay? So the other blocks are the couplings between the boundary fluctuations and the bulk fluctuations, or the other way around here. And eventually you have a coupling between boundary fluctuations and themselves. All right? So now again, I look at null vectors because they are the gauge symmetries. So I find that you find null vectors corresponding to vertex displacements in the bulk. And in the bulk means the vertices that lie on the central axis. I have no other vertices inside. So they are basically the same gauge degrees of freedom I told you about in the first part. But you also find some null vectors that affect the boundary fluctuations. So you find vertex displacements on the boundary in the time direction, but time direction only. You don't find them in the angular direction. They're not null vectors. Okay? So it kind of breaks the symmetry, the angular symmetry. So again, you perform a Fourier transform. And this Fourier transform decouples all the frequencies, all the modes. So you can integrate the bulk fluctuations. And this way you get an effective Hessian matrix for the fluctuations. So I have fluctuations on boundary, and I integrate the fluctuations in bulk. I get some effective Hessian for boundary only. So this effective Hessian looks like, well, first you have the boundary-to-boundary coupling that you had in your Hessian. And then, well, you're on the boundary, you couple to the bulk through that H bulk boundary, so you couple through the bulk. Then you apply the coupling of the bulk to itself, to the minus one, and then back to the boundary using the Hermitian conjugate of that one. Okay, so just in Gaussian integration, basically. So we look at it in the basis where, so I told you have three types of edges, the horizontal, the diagonal ones, and the vertical ones on the boundary. I'm not showing you this matrix because it wouldn't fit the page, actually. It's quite big. Although you only have three variables, you know, each entry is like kind of big. So you look at this, the null vectors again. Now it's the null vectors for the effective Hessian on the boundary. So you find a single null vector, and it corresponds to displacements in the time direction. So it's not surprising because I told you that the full Hessian before integration of the bulk degrees of freedom, I told you that that Hessian has null vectors corresponding to displacements on the boundary in the time direction. So obviously, if you integrate the bulk degrees of freedom, you still get those null vectors, I mean that one. And you only have that one, in fact. So then it's time to take the continuum limit, right? So you send L to 0 or A to 0, I mean whatever parameter you've chosen to control that continuum limit. And you look at the matrix. I'm going to show it to you in a few sec. Just the main thing is that you still have no invariance under vertex displacement in the angular direction. Okay? So you don't restore it just like that. You don't restore that invariance. So the matrix, I can show it to you. It looks like this. So now it fits the page. So the Fourier modes are K and V. So I kind of changed the notation for the time frequencies, now V. So it looks like this. The only thing I want you to notice is that all the matrix entries are even polynomials of degree 2 in the Fourier modes. Okay? So you have things like K squared, V squared, or K times V, right? And some constants here, for example. So what you do is you keep only the terms of degree 2 in the Fourier modes, basically because they can be arbitrarily large in the continuum limit. So you just keep those. And this time you find two null vectors if you do that. So you find the time displacements and also the angular displacements. So you restore them like that. Okay, so I told you before, Carlip and other people using Chern-Simons or the metric formalism, they used a relationship in the ADS3 case. They found a relationship between 3D gravity and the Liouville action on the boundary. So can we look at that? So I had a 3 by 3 matrix here, and I'm telling you I have two null vectors. So I'm left with a single non-vanishing eigenvalue. And that eigenvalue looks like this. So the reason I'm showing it to you is that on the denominator here, I have V squared, and that's all. So I added plus K squared because if you discretize Liouville theory, you would have the same thing, but you will have V squared plus K squared. And we don't have it. So that's the difference, basically. So we don't quite get UVA theory. I think we should definitely investigate more closely the derivation of that Liouville action in the continuum and try to compare it to our formalism, right? To see where it's very different. And because I keep on telling you that the degrees of freedom come from the fluctuations of those edges that are incident to the boundary. And here, I integrated them over. And I only kept the fluctuations of the boundary metric frozen. So maybe I shouldn't have integrated the variables R, the radius of the torus. Maybe I should have kept it, because maybe that's the Liouville field, kind of. So still work to be done. Here's a summary of the kind of thing I told you about. So we really discretized and then took the continuum limit in a gravitational model. Although pretty simple, it is a gravitational model. So we consider a real linearized Reggio calculus, and we showed that you can reproduce the one loop calculation that leads to the BMS character. So I think so it kind of probes the structure, the algebraic structure of the theory, and it's quite good that we can reproduce that result. In particular, we can show that the one-loop determinant is invariant under coarse graining in the time direction. However, in the angular direction on the boundary torus, you do need the continuum limit. It is required in the angular direction. Then in the second part of the talk, I fixed the fluctuations on the boundary to be arbitrary fluctuations, still working at a finite radius r. And then I told you that to restore the symmetries, you need the continuum limit in both directions, both time and angular directions. So maybe a way out would be, I mean, it's a very natural idea that was performed explicitly by Benjamin Bohr, Janka Dietrich, in the context of three-dimensional space-time with constant curvature. So if you do Reggio calculus with a flat symplasis, in that case, you find that the gauge symmetries are broken. Because basically, you use flat pieces to describe some space-time of constant curvature. So it doesn't seem like a very good idea. And it could be more natural to use symplasis which have the same constant curvature. So if you do that, you find that you restore the symmetry. meaning that the Hessian for rigid calculus with symplices of constant curvature will have the gauge symmetries you expect from the continuous. Okay, so maybe here in that case it means that on the boundary, remember I triangulated boundary, the circle to be a polygon. So maybe instead I should use triangles that have some constant extrinsic curvature on the boundary, and they would preserve invariance under angular diffeomorphisms. Maybe. There's something I kind of left out in the talk. It's the measure. I didn't discuss it at all. So we know from Bianca Dietrich and Sebastian Steinhaus that we do know a measure that makes 3D linearized gravity, 3D linearized rigid calculus invariant under Packner moves, meaning invariant under change of triangulations. But that works in the bulk very, very nicely. However, if you do have a boundary, it's not so clear what kind of measure terms we should use. In particular, in that calculation, I really ignore, just to show you nice things, I ignore the not so nice things, which are R-dependent and N-dependent terms coming, for example, from the gauge modes. Once you gauge fix, you still have some integration to perform, and that leads you to, that gives you some terms that I left out. Okay, some perspectives. Well, so far I worked with finite radius, but you can send it to infinity. So here is my Einstein-Hilbert term. Here is the Gibbons-Hawking-York term on the boundary. And for finite R, you know you have to take alpha equals 1 here. When you work with boundary at infinity, it's not so clear. Some people very recently did a calculation and they showed that if the fall-off condition for the metric coefficients are strong enough, you can actually use any alpha here. But if your fall-off conditions are not so strong, then you are forced to work with alpha equals 1/2. Alpha equals 1/2. And not alpha equals 1, as you would expect at finite radius. So that's something we haven't really investigated, meaning that the R goes to infinity limit is not so simple. You can't just work at finite R and then send R to infinity. There's the ADS case that's already under investigation. So that would be adding some constant curvature. You can also try to change the topology and perform a similar calculation. So typically, I was told that the ring configuration could be interesting. So the ring is basically a cylinder where you cut and remove a smaller cylinder from the inside. So you have a ring structure. And I was told that that's interesting for tensor network renormalization, maybe. So I told you about the relationship to Liouville theory. That still has to be investigated. And because we are able to reproduce that determinant that's related to a character of the BMS algebra, natural question is whether we can identify some charges on the boundary in the discrete level. So charges and generators of the asymptotic symmetries. Okay, so if we want to do that, we have to choose some Hamiltonian formulation, and we have, there's been some people who worked on that. Maybe one way to do it nicely would be to, instead of using the metric formalism, meaning the edge length in rigid calculus, maybe we could use the BF theory. So I just want to say a few words. And the BF theory is nice because usually you can do non-perturbative things with it. So, BF theory leads you to a quantum non-perturbative version that we call the Pantin-Régier model instead of Régier calculus. And I was told this morning that Ettore Alivin and Aldo Riello already did the calculation this week. Okay? So I can't show you because I'm not really aware, but you can ask them. So it works kind of similarly. Obviously, you have to gauge fix the Pantin-Régier model, but we know how to do that. Also, the boundary states on the boundary will be spin networks, typically. But then you have to choose your boundary conditions. And in the context of BF theory, you have several choices. So I want to tell you something very short about that. So boundary conditions in BF theory. So this is the BF theory. I think Wolfgang wrote that action very early this morning. So you take, so it depends on a connection A, and here you have the curvature of A, dA plus A wedge A. And then you introduce a field that you call B, and that's basically a Lagrange multiplier for the curvature. So you can think of it as a Lagrange multiplier quite generally, but in 3D it turns out to be the metric, in fact, roughly speaking, or the square root of the metric. So now if you look at variations of the BF action, well, you get three types of terms. The first one, when you look, when you have the variations of B, obviously, because B is a Lagrange multiplier, it imposes F equals 0 here. Then you have the variations of A here, and after some integration by parts, it imposes that the covariant derivative of B along A is 0. But because you did some integration by parts, you have boundary term here, looking like the trace of B wedge fluctuations of A. So it means that if you fix the connection on boundary, so you have delta A equals 0 on the boundary, well, you can forget about that term, right? However, if you decide to fix the metric, which means fix B, so B is fixed, may be non-zero, and the fluctuations here may be arbitrary, so you need a counter term, and the counter term would be basically a trace of B wedge A, and that thing is certainly not gauge invariant. So if you do gauge transformation, you would have the gauge parameter appearing here. So it's the same mechanism I told you about, that's completely generic for gauge theory with the boundary. Okay?
Okay. So this can be understood because you keep the B field fixed, which is not gauge invariant.
Sure. Sure. You can say that. I mean, there are, yeah. So I don't know what happens if you keep the B field fixed on the boundary, but I can certainly tell you what happens if you keep the connection fixed on the boundary. So that was the last couple of slides. If you keep the connection fixed on the boundary, it's actually well known, although it's still under investigation. It's been studied a lot in the past years. So you end up with theory of flat connections, meaning that the states on the boundary in your Hilbert space have to, so I call them flat states, and they have to satisfy some Hamiltonian constraints. And because you discretize a topological theory, you can express those constraints on a single graph. So the dynamics only concern states on a single graph. You don't need graph changing in that case. So we showed recently that you can, yeah, that you do have an algebra of discretized constraints, a closed algebra. And if you work in the spin basis, so you keep the connection fixed on the boundary, so you have holonomies, and you do Fourier transform on SU2, so instead of holonomies, you get spins, SU2 spins, right? So in that case, the constraints, the Hamiltonian constraints, leads you to recursion relations on the state psi, okay? Psi of J, J are the spins, and you have recursions, meaning you have some shifts of the spin, epsilon, and psi evaluated on J plus epsilon, with some coefficient here. So the solutions of those constraints are always, locally, they're always evaluation of spin networks. Obviously, you have topological degrees of freedom, but locally, they're always spin network evaluations. So then you can look at what happens if you change the boundary triangulation. So you can do 3 to 1, 1 to 3, and 2 to 2 Wagner moves that change. So those moves generate all the possible change of boundary triangulations. And imagine you have two different triangulations. They're related by a Wagner move, but they're a different triangulation. You have a state psi r, an initial state, and a final state psi f on the other triangulation. So two triangulations, one state on each of them. and they both satisfy the constraints. So you can show, using the recursion relations only, you can show that you always have a relation of that type. So you take your initial state, multiply by a 6J symbol, and maybe you have to sum sometimes, but not always, but you have that structure all the time. And so that's something that's not yet on the archive, but you can prove that also in the case, in the Q-deformed case, where Q is real. You can prove that only using recursion relations. So it's, I mean, it's not so obvious because those states live on different Hilbert spaces, right? So how do you compare them? And here, you can just compare their coefficients in the spin network basis. And you find that relation between the coefficients of the state in a certain basis, right? So it gives you actually the embedding maps that Bianca talks often about. And so what does that mean? It means that you have states on different triangulation, and one triangulation may be coarser or finer than the other one. And you, when you want to compare those states, well, you have to find a way to embed the states that live on a coarse triangulations into the states that live in the finer triangulation. Okay? So you can do that using that, that relation here.
If you do such a mapping, do you know whether this transformation loses information? I mean, if you go from fine to coarse, you probably do, but if you go from fine to fine, can you still lose information?
Lose information? No, we don't.
Yeah, in the sense that in the sense that it's a projection that projects out information.
No,
I mean,
not
if
sure
you go
be,
from fine to coarse, you do. So.
Well, that's a topological theory. So anyway, locally, you never have degrees of freedom. So because those local, the moves are local, you never really lose information.
But yeah, also in general, the
isometries.
Isometries.
Yes,
all right. It's isometric, the course of the defining the unifier to be the isometric.
Okay.
That means the sense of losing information.
Okay, so my point was that if you fix the connection, you, all the coarse graining issues can be answered in 3D. And you can also compare to what people, because I keep saying that 3D gravity is topological. So this partition function should be a topological invariant, right? So which one it is? Whether it, it's known or not known, well, it's actually well known. So you, to introduce you to it, let's say you take a discrete connections, which means a set of holonomies on the edges. You introduce your notion of discrete curvature, which is the product of the holonomies around the faces. You have gauge transformation. So if you have a holonomy G of, on the edge E, you act with group elements on the vertices, so on the source of the edge and on the target of the edge, that gives you a new holonomy. And you have another set of gauge transformation, which actually represent the vertex displacements I keep telling you about in this talk. So if you, so this vertex displacement can be understood in the context of BF theory, in the dual lattice, so in the dual, that would be the action of three cells, okay? Because the vertices are dual to three cells. So if you move the vertex, it means the three cell acts on the triangulation, on the graph. And then you can perform that integral. So you integrate over all the discrete connection, and you want the discrete connection to have a trivial curvature. So you add a delta function on the on the discrete curvature. So basically, it's the volume of the set of flat connections, right? So it's gauge invariant, and they're both those gauge transformations. And if you gauge fix, you find that it's a sum over all flat connections, all equivalence classes of flat connections, I should say, of something that's called the R torsion, the Rademeister torsion, or Rademeister-Franz torsion, various names for it. So it's a quantity that's known since the 1930s. So it's a very classical invariant of manifolds. So although it's a classical one, it's still quite powerful. It distinguishes manifolds quite in a nice way in 3D. And my point is that you can actually extend that to the presence of a boundary. You just have to use something called relative cohomology. So it's not too complicated, but it makes the thing kind of messy. So I wouldn't explain that in the 4 minutes left. But you can do it. Again, that's what happens if you decide to keep the connection fixed on the boundary and not the metric. Okay, so thank you for your attention. Okay, so time for questions. Yep.
So the boundary you showed, which you need to add for fixed V.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be the same as doing the first calculating with fixed A and doing the Fourier transform for the wave function?
I don't know. Maybe because it really looks.
Looks a bit like.
Yeah, it does. It does. Maybe.
So it would maybe be easier to do. Then you can actually apply the Weidemann principle.
Yeah, because the key points, several people were in 3D gravity. Some people look at the calculations where you get this kind of one loop determinant I told you about, related to Virasoro or BMS group, and some people look. The earlier calculation involved the Riedemeister torsion. So natural question was whether those one loop determinant are related to the torsion, and we still don't know about that. Okay, so that's what Bianca is suggesting, that maybe if I keep the connection fixed, I can apply the Riedemeister torsion thing, and then maybe this boundary term that I have to add to keep the metric fixed instead of the connection, it looks like a Fourier transform. Okay, so maybe I can work with the fixed connection, apply the Riedemeister torsion techniques, and then do a Fourier transform on the boundary. I don't know, maybe.
But for the Riedemeister torsion, you keep fixed flat connection score.
On the boundary it's arbitrary. The point is that it's zero if it's not flat on the boundary.
Okay.
Because you still have the equations of motion here, and they hold for the whole manifold.
So the wave function is zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so then you can do.
Yeah, it's just that, okay. Here, that's the continuous version. So how do you do it in the discrete using spin networks? It may not be so obvious. I don't know.
But then it's still the spin network
Yeah.
I have a very naive question.
Okay, good.
I haven't yet quite understood where in the discrete setting the Fourier translation in the angular direction, why that is broken. Because when I think of Regge calculus,
yep.
If I take the Sorkin boundary term on shell naively, I always get 2 pi beta. Even if I'm at the
coordinate,
right? So shouldn't I be able to, deform things also in the angular direction and still
so,
use the
action? So I think that you think that when you think of a slice, okay? Do you follow me? If you think of a slice, then you discretize with any polygon, okay? Mm-hmm. The sum of the angles will always be 2 pi, okay? So and then you get 2 pi beta if you do that. But the thing is that it's not so simple, because you really have a triangulation on the boundary. So let me, here. So, and if you start to move your vertex here, those edges will be modified. Those edges, okay.
Okay.
And if you evaluate the change of dihedral angles, in the angular direction, you find that it works only if the time steps are equal. Because basically, you get a plus epsilon variation for that edge, minus epsilon for that edge. So,
I see.
Yeah. So they cancel only if Tn equals Tn plus 1.
Oh, yeah. yeah, no, I was, you're right. I was having in mind doing this all, you know, the parallel in T direction.
Yeah.
And if you do that kind of transformation,
yeah. That's what I was talking about, a slice.
Yeah.
You slice it, you have a polygon, and then you make it completely parallel in the time direction, and you always get 2 pi beta. But it's not so simple if you think about it on a triangulation like that.
And also about the boundary.
No, I mean, we're talking about the boundary.
Yeah. Thank you for that point. Another question or a coffee break? Okay, I'm here for the whole week, so if you have further questions.